draw near to their attention, pointing out that God saved the United States and John the Holy Spirit.
Good morning, everybody. David Brandt. Bryant, pardon me? Right.
Good morning, Your Honor. Good morning. Brother Daly, appearing as a sponsor for my partner, David Adam Bryant, to be admitted to this court.
Is he licensed to practice?
Yes, he is.
And where?
In Illinois.
In Illinois?
In Wisconsin, too, I believe.
In the state of Illinois, Your Honor.
And what law school did you do?
John Marshall Law School, Your Honor.
Fine. Does anybody object?
Oh, he's licensed to practice in Wisconsin. That ought to make him pretty good.
You are admitted. Please go over and take the oath, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
On behalf of the court.
Thank you.
Probably a majority opinion, at least.
Brian Thomas versus James Doyle.
Kermit Roosevelt for Petitioner Appellant Brian Thomas. May it please the Court, the issues in this case have proliferated, but I think it's still fairly simple to reach the conclusion that the District Court's dismissal should be reversed. I'd like to start by considering the new arguments that appellees have offered, and then, time permitting, move on to the District Court's decision. First, the exhaustion argument. This Court should not consider the issue of exhaustion for two reasons. First, the District Court, as it recognized, did not have the power to consider exhaustion sua sponte at this stage in the case. The language of 1997E makes this clear, and the Ray Third Circuit opinion cited in our Rule 28J letter holds this explicitly. Second, even if the court did have the power to consider exhaustion, it expressly declined to do so, and it was not required to. And since the exhaustion defense turns on matters outside the pleadings, it would be inappropriate for this court to consider the issue on appeal. But even if the court does decide to consider the exhaustion argument, it should reject it. Appellees, in essence, argue that untimely exhaustion is not exhaustion at all. But this position has no support in logic or in the language of the PLRA itself. First, what does the statute say? It says an inmate may not sue until such administrative remedies as are available are exhausted.
I know this is a very recent opinion, Thomas versus Daw. Are you aware of that one?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
It was issued 2 days ago. It was on this issue, and it came down against your position.
Pozo.
Pozo.
I would be happy to address that case in supplemental briefing.
I didn't want you to go on without understanding we've already ruled on part of the issue that you're addressing.
Could you tell me exactly what that case ruled?
Well, in essence, it makes it very difficult to proceed in a case where there has not been an appeal timely filed to the state administrative administrative review procedures, appellate part of that.
Is that a
after you finish your argument? If you walk up, I'll hand you a copy of it.
Thank you. Well, I would be happy to address that case in supplemental briefing, but
you'd probably be better off concentrating on your two opening arguments rather than try to overturn a recent decision.
Okay. On those points, as the district court recognized, first, it doesn't have the power to consider exhaustion sua sponte when it's doing the 1997 EC screening. Two circuits actually have held that. There's the Snyder decision from the Second Circuit and the Ray decision from the Third Circuit. And second, the district court expressly declined to consider exhaustion, and I haven't seen any authority suggesting that there's anything requiring it to do so.
You don't have a lot of time here, and why don't you talk about the equal protection argument here and why the prison officials couldn't treat the washer differently than the washee?
I don't believe that is such an obvious distinction that we would be compelled to believe that was the distinction on which the governmental differential in treatment was based. At the pleading stage, I think we have to accept Thomas's allegation that he was treated differently because of his race. That's a factual allegation. And there is Seventh Circuit case law saying that at the pleading stage, you don't resolve factual questions such as what the distinction was against the pleader. Now, as my brief said,
so would you say that if this was cases beyond the pleading stage, that the prison officials would have to treat the two people identically here?
I don't think they necessarily would. I think that there would be a factual question as to what the distinction that they drew was. If the distinction they drew was between the person who initiated the conduct and the person who didn't, they might be able to defend on that ground. I'm not sure why that would justify imposing punitive measures on a person who's in administered segregation, since the justification that the government offered for this differential in treatment, the justification the district court assumed, was that it prevents people from hindering the investigation. And I don't see why the different roles alleged here would relate to a difference in treatment for that purpose. With regard to the reasoning that the district court did employ, what it did was to look at the treatment to which Thomas was subjected as if it were a policy of general applicability, rather than trying to justify the differential in treatment between the black inmate and the white inmate. That analysis is simply inconsistent with Supreme Court precedent and with the cases of this court. For that reason, we think that the dismissal of the equal protection claims should be reversed. The equal protection claims based on sexual orientation and disability, the district court relied on its analysis of the race-based claims in order to dismiss those. So that dismissal should be reversed as well. With regard to the question on which this court ordered briefing, whether a plaintiff whose discrimination claim receives rational basis review has to allege facts sufficient to overcome a presumption of rationality, the Supreme Court's recent decision in Swierkiewicz v. Sorema establishes quite clearly that federal courts cannot impose a heightened pleading standard for a certain category of cases. This court in some cases has suggested that a heightened pleading standard is appropriate, apparently because it supposes that animus is relevant to a rational basis equal protection claim, that animus can establish irrationality, or even in class of one cases, that animus is required to establish irrationality. But the Supreme Court has said that this is not so. In FCC v. Beach Communications, in Village of Willowbrook v. Olick, and most recently in University of Alabama v. Garrett, irrationality and animus are not the same thing. An actual motive is irrelevant to a rational basis analysis. The district court also dismissed procedural due process claims on the grounds that there's no liberty interest in avoiding administrative segregation. Now, that may or may not be true, but Thomas also lost good time credit, and that pushed back his mandatory release date. Under the Supreme Court's decision in Greenholz and this court's decision in Montgomery, he had a protectable liberty interest in the mandatory release date established by his good time credit. That dismissal also should be reversed. Last, the district court dismissed the state law claims because no federal claims remained. Since the dismissal of the federal claims was error, the state law claims should be reinstated as well. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Here's a copy of that opinion.
Here's a copy.
May it please the court? I'm Andrea Baker, the attorney representing the respondents' appellees in this case. We concede that the district court erred in its analysis of Thomas's equal protection claims and concede that if he'd timely exhausted his administrative remedies...
Can you talk a little louder, please? Thank you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. We concede that if he'd timely exhausted his administrative remedies, reversal would be warranted as to the equal protection claims. Our position is that this court should affirm the dismissal on alternate grounds. First, because taking Thomas's allegations as true, he waited 3 years to exhaust his administrative remedies, which shows on his face that he admits that he did not timely exhaust, which under POSO is no exhaustion. Second, because as to his due process claim, Thomas had available to him an adequate post-deprivation remedy and certiorari review. And we also stand behind a request for two strikes in this case.
Why should the district court have dismissed this case on its own motion here? This is a failure to exhaust is an affirmative defense that the state has to raise.
Well, we agree that it's an affirmative defense, but there is case law from other jurisdictions indicating that under the PLRA, a court may consider affirmative defenses sua sponte. And I think that it would further the purposes and the goals of the PLRA to allow a court to raise exhaustion sua sponte. And I think that this is a poster child case for adoption of the Sixth Circuit rule that inmates must make an affirmative showing of exhaustion. Because in this particular case, this inmate has persisted in ongoing repetitive litigation without exhausting, and he's wasted considerable state and judicial resources all the way over the last 2 years. 3 years prior to filing the case at bar, Thomas sought certiorari review of the underlying prison discipline in the Circuit Court for Dane County, Wisconsin, which dismissed his lawsuit because he failed to exhaust his administrative remedies. He appealed to the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, which affirmed the dismissal, and he sought review in the Wisconsin Supreme Court, which denied his petition for review. He next commenced a federal habeas proceeding by filing a petition in the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Wisconsin. And in that case, he raised two issues. First, that he was mistreated in segregation at Waupun arising from this incident. And second, he challenged his loss of 90 days good time credit. The district court dismissed, finding, among other things, that Thomas had failed to exhaust any of his administrative remedies relating to his alleged mistreatment in segregation. And he appealed to this court, which affirmed. And Thomas was told multiple times that he'd not exhausted, but he nonetheless persisted in filing legal actions. In June of 2000, Thomas filed a complaint in the United States District Court for the Western District of Wisconsin, complaining of the same incident. He then requested dismissal because he hadn't exhausted. On January 11, 2001, Thomas filed the present action using pleadings from the June 2000 action, and although he claimed at that time that he exhausted his remedies relating to this April 1997 event, well more than 3 years after the fact, what could that possibly mean in light of the requirements of the Wisconsin Administrative Code? And does he mean to say that he finally appealed a negative first step decision handed to him 3 years previously? If so, he didn't timely appeal. And does he mean to say he filed a new grievance 3 years after the fact? If so, he didn't timely file his grievance. His Exhibit A to the 2000 complaint is in the appendix of his reply brief at A4. But this is only a first-step grievance, and it doesn't even show what the administrative decision was. In January 2001, Thomas provided another document located in the appendix of his reply brief at A1 through 3, which purported to show an appeal, but that purported appeal was addressed to the wrong individual, the warden, not the corrections complaint examiner, as specifically required by the Wisconsin Administrative Code, Section DOC 310.13. And again, he didn't attach the relevant administrative decision. He could have just made this up. His documents show no exhaustion. But since he alleges exhaustion, we turn to the administrative code and argue that any administrative appeal would be untimely. Therefore, there was no exhaustion, and it would conserve considerable judicial resources if a court could simply consider exhaustion sua sponte. In his brief in chief.
I haven't looked at the forms that they use now for pro se prisoner complaints, but are there instructions on the forms regarding pleading of exhaustion?
Yes. They ask a question as to whether you exhausted and what your outcome was, but inmates are not required to use the pro se forms, and I see Section 1983 complaints coming in on a variety of types of paper.
I think there's some logic to your argument about the judge being able to look at whether there's exhaustion or not and cut these cases out early. But what is the notice to a pro se prisoner that they have to put in their complaint enough information so that the district judge will know that there's been exhaustion?
Well, in the Second Circuit, opposing counsel cited a case called Snyder versus Melendez, where a dismissal had been reversed, and the dismissal had been based on a sua sponte consideration of an inmate's failure to exhaust. And what the Second Circuit held was that although they were dismissing or reversing that case, They were reversing that case because the inmate hadn't been given notice and opportunity to respond to the court's concern with exhaustion. And I would see no problem with an inmate being told, you have to exhaust, here are the documents that you must supply, and if the inmate can't supply them, then the case should be dismissed. Additionally, we submit that the court's February decision in Porter also bolsters our position that exhaustion is so integral to the PLRA that judges may dismiss on their own motion. In Porter, the court held that once within the discretion of the district court, exhaustion in cases covered by Section 1997EA is now mandatory. All available remedies must now be exhausted. If the Porter court stated that all remedies must be exhausted and that the district courts no longer have discretion to require exhaustion, it certainly indicates that a court seeking to abide by the letter and spirit of the PLRA should be able to dismiss on exhaustion grounds. As to Thomas's due process claim, we don't dispute that inmates have a protected liberty interest in the retention of earned good time credit. But the rule in this circuit, taken from Hamlin versus Vaudenberg, is that the Wisconsin remedies of certiorari review and the inmate complaint review system are adequate post-deprivation remedies. Hamlin, which came after Smith, which opposing counsel relied on in their reply brief, stands for the proposition that the code doesn't allow unfettered discretion in disciplinary proceedings, and an examination of the code itself shows the same thing. In his reply brief, Thomas also contended that Hamlin was inapplicable because Thomas alleged violations of federal law, not state law, as was the case in Hamlin. But Thomas is wrong. In Hamlin, the plaintiff alleged that his 14th Amendment due process rights had been violated because the defendant prison officials violated state law. But Hamlin was not just about state law. On page 584 in Hamlin, the court specifically said, now on to the merits of Hamlin's procedural due process claim. The court noted that if state procedures allow unfettered discretion by state actors, then an abuse of that discretion may be predictable and preventable with pre-deprivation process. However, on page 585, the court noted Smith that went on to conclude that certiorari review and the inmate complaint review system offered Wisconsin inmates adequate post-deprivation remedies under a due process analysis. Thomas had no liberty interest in staying out of segregation, and as for the loss of good time credits, he had an adequate post-deprivation remedy in certiorari review. And that's the crux of my argument.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Let me try to address just a few points. With regard to the exhaustion question, what the government has been saying here about the propriety of the district court raising issues sua sponte really is not applicable in this case because the district court didn't raise it sua sponte. They're not trying to defend a sua sponte dismissal on exhaustion grounds. They're trying to offer an alternative ground. Now, the government says, we're fine with the notice and hearing requirement before dismissal, which is what Snyder holds, basically. But obviously, in that case, that would mean that they lose because not only did the district court not notify Thomas that it was considering dismissal on exhaustion grounds, it didn't dismiss on exhaustion grounds at all. You can't offer exhaustion as an alternative ground for affirmance if you say that dismissal for exhaustion should be preceded by notice in a hearing. Now, with regard to the procedural due process claims, Hamlin, as we read it, says that when what a plaintiff offers as a due process violation is the failure to observe state procedures, then you look at whether there's an adequate post-deprivation remedy. As Hamlin noted in Whitford, another one of this court's cases, you had allegations that there were violations of federal law, not state law, and in that case, the court did not look at the post-deprivation remedies available. It went on to do an ordinary due process analysis. What Thomas alleged was the deprivation of two specific procedural rights guaranteed by the Due Process Clause, the right to confront his accusers and the right to present documentary evidence. He alleged that those rights were denied him pursuant to the broadly delegated discretion afforded state corrections officers, and that brings his claims under Zinnerman. One last point, with respect to the two strikes here, the district court held that Thomas had not failed to state a claim with respect to his state claims. That's why it didn't enter a strike below. The government doesn't even address that, and I don't think that a strike would be justified for that reason. On the appeal, the government is trying to defend a dismissal on grounds that the district court didn't even consider. And the dismissal was, in fact, based on grounds that they concede are incorrect. I don't think that an appeal from that dismissal can fairly be called frivolous.
Thank you, counsel. We will take the case under advisement.